You are listening to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thanks so much for joining me again this week, where we talk about all things policing, have very interesting guests, and we talk about the things that really matter to America's law enforcement and those who support them. There's a lot to talk about today, and let's get right into it. Let's take a walk into the briefing room, where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. The Sergeants Benevolent Association in New York City, they are the union that represents all the sergeants, and believe me, there is a whole lot of them in New York City Police Department. They've come up with a very novel approach for turning the tide when it comes to people who are attacking physically law enforcement officers. What they've done is they've instituted a $500 reward for citizens who, observing law enforcement officers who are in physical confrontations, step in to assist them. I have a couple of thoughts on this. First of all, I wish it weren't necessary. That is, I wish it weren't necessary to have to institute a reward system and pay people to do something that, you know, they really should do if they have the physical abilities to do it anyway. You know, there have been, believe me, there have been plenty of incidents where people step in, not only during simple physical confrontations, but in life-threatening situations where a police officer is on the brink of death and people step in and assist them. That has happened on more than one occasion. And then there have been plenty of times which I'm sure go unheralded as far as people stepping in to assist. But there have been a whole lot, and a couple of them recently, where a police officer was in a real knockdown, drag-out fight. This occurred recently, where a police officer was fighting with a suspect. I mean, it was a real fight. And there was a security guard in full uniform watching, and of course, everybody is standing around videotaping the fight instead of helping. And one of the people videotaping, of course, there were many, videotaped the security officer in full uniform who was videotaping, not stepping in to assist. And this officer is begging this security officer, it's a female, for help. And he's going, "So don't stand there, help me." And instead of even acknowledging or calling 911 or doing anything to assist, this sorry excuse for a security officer just walked around filming him. I wanted to crawl through the computer screen and give that security officer a little bit of the same medicine that officer was taking. But in essence, when it was made public, that security officer was no longer employed as a security officer, and that is as it should be. So the police union for the Sheriff's Benevolent Association is creating a financial reward for citizens who assist officers during difficult arrests instead of filming them, and they'll get $500. I hope that they get a lot of takers. That is, I hope that that a lot of people decide to put the camera down and step in. And that's something that, if you ask me, should be done simply because that's the human, compassionate thing to do. It shouldn't require a payment. But it is certainly an interesting way to combat the problem, and we'll see how that goes. There was an interesting story that came out of Las Vegas, in essence, out of Las Vegas. It's kind of a feel-good story in a way. We have all mourned the many, many victims of the October 1st shooting that happened last year. 58 people dead, 500 people injured. It was madness. Still no reason to this day that anybody knows why the shooter did it. But There was a huge law enforcement and first responder response. In fact, a Metro police officer lost his life that day. That was killed in the fighting. Well, a woman who survived the Las Vegas shooting has become a cop, inspired by the police response. And I find this to be not only interesting, but what I would say inspiring. Her name is Lauren Card. She's 23 years old. She witnessed the chaos and tragedy as the law enforcement officers ran towards the gunfire when Stephen Paddock started shooting from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. She was so inspired by what she saw that she has joined the Springfield, Oregon Police Department. She was sworn in on August 20th. And what she said was, I'm going to quote, "And in that moment, I kind of had a sense that, okay, the police are here. They're going to fix it. They're going to make it better. Everything's going to be okay." That's what she told the newspaper up in Oregon. That's what cops do. That's what cops have done for years and years and years. Run towards the sound of the gunfire and do what they could to make it better. I have a feeling she has a long and interesting career ahead of her. She's certainly going into it for the right reasons. She's going into law enforcement because she believes that she can make a difference. And that's, in essence, what almost all police officers enter the field for. And while we're talking about that, there was another headline that came out from a police agency in Ohio, and the police chief was lamenting that he can't hire enough people because there aren't enough applicants. And all I can say is, well, gee, what a shock. This is something we're seeing across the country. People are saying, why would I do this job? Especially, they're paying them $9 an hour in this police department. $9 an hour. And for that, you are going to face literally life and death danger. You're going to have to take a bunch of verbal garbage from people who you're going to arrest. You have to worry about the next piece of social media videotape that could destroy your life. You have to worry about the safety of your family if you do anything that in the public's perception is untoward, whether it truly is or not. So as we see this deterioration of respect for law enforcement, the obvious conclusion and ramifications and long-term issues are going to be a lack of the ability to hire people that are suitable for the job. You know, one of the things that knocks out most police candidates is background checks. So you want the best qualified applicant. And if the pool of applicants dries up or becomes, shall we say, shallow, what happens? You wind up hiring people who shouldn't be hired because the departments are desperate. And then this whole syndrome of unsuitable police officers then becomes the self-fulfilling prophecy. People are constantly accusing police officers who are doing nothing wrong of wrongdoing. And then when we are going to see, as we have seen in the past, hiring that is based on either politics or convenience or, in this case, maybe panic because there aren't enough applicants, we're going to see a diminishment of law enforcement. We're going to see a diminishment of the quality of law enforcement. And we need to be going in the opposite direction. We need to be creating an environment where people want to become cops again. And we give them the support and we give them the benefits. Another thing that's been happening is the benefits that were often given to police officers, like pension systems, are being withdrawn. And in some cases, they're being put onto plans which will, you know, not give them the security that they need at the end of a career. So America needs to wake up here. The politicians need to step up to the plate and say, you know what? We recognize that there's a problem. We need to, instead of degrading our law enforcement, we need to upgrade our law enforcement, and we need to do it by treating them humanely, giving them the benefits and the salaries that a professional deserves. I mean, I just got back from Oklahoma, and a police officer who I had interviewed in relation to my upcoming film, The Wounded Blue, this guy was a lieutenant. He's making $40,000 a year as a lieutenant. Well, that's not a lot of money by anybody's standards. And these officers take these incredible risks. It's time that we standardize the pay of law enforcement around the country so that police departments don't have to rob personnel from each other in order to give them better benefits and pay. It's time to professionalize this profession. And the only way to do that is by paying people decent living salaries and decent living benefits. That's part of my soapbox today. I want to tell you about an incident that occurred, and it's very, very disturbing. This occurred in Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, I want you to listen closely to what happened, and tell me if you're as disturbed about this issue as I am. There was a group of 5-year-olds. You hear that? 5-year-olds. Group of 5-year-old black children who were playing hide and seek. When one of the players, a little participant, little girl, 5 years old, went home, the mother saw that she was covered in urine and asked the little girl what had happened. And the little girl told her that a white man who lived down the street had found her hiding behind a bush while she was playing hide and seek, urinated on her, and called her the N-word. Well, the mother, of course, is you know, shocked at this, calls the other little kids in, this whole group of them, and they all tell the same story. Oh, yeah, it was this man who lives over there, and he called her the N-word, and he urinated on her. So she calls the police. The police take a report. They've discovered that this suspect is actually a registered sex offender. So they're all over this thing, and they go and they, on the word of these children, they take him to jail. This guy's facing a serious, serious prison sentence, right? Well, when the police did their investigation, they discovered that he had an ironclad alibi. He wasn't anywhere near the place when it happened. So they called in some experts who are experts at questioning children. And they discovered that they made the whole damn thing up. The little girl, one of her friends, friends like this, who needs enemies, one of her little friends decided to pee on her. So they didn't want him to get in trouble. So they made this up, and they used race as a way to sensationalize it and make it that much more believable. Where does a 5-year-old, where does a group of 5-year-olds come up with a conspiracy like this? Where do they get the sophistication to understand that this case would be so shocking that everyone would get crazy about it? And they did. I mean, I'm going to read the headlines. Headlines: man urinates on 5-year-old black girl, calls her N-word. Next one: man accused of urinating on black girl using racial slur has mental problems. Grand Rapids man accused of urinating on black child, calling her N-word. Man pees on black girl, calls her a racial slur. So you can imagine what kind of emotional response happened here. And it was all made up. It was made up by a bunch of children who, where did they get the idea in the first place? This I find very, very disturbing. And I hope that law enforcement in Grand Rapids takes a long, hard look at this, because I got to tell you, I think it comes from listening to your parents and listening to your family and your social environment. And if that's where these kids are getting it, we got serious problems in the future. Well, that, my friends, is my view from the blue, and we'll see you again shortly in the interview room with an incredible guest. If you're a police officer, or if you are a spouse or a family member, one of the things that is very necessary to help save lives are the ballistic vests and the body armor that police officers wear. The problem with that is that they're uncomfortable. They're hot, especially in the summertime. They get wet, they get sweaty, they get nasty, and it's part of the deal. I mean, you gotta wash them, you gotta take care of them, that's one of the problems with having a ballistic vest. There is a new product, and I kind of like it. They call it StinkyVest.com. That's the company, and they arrest odors. I love it, and this is really good stuff. You don't have to just use it for vests. It's good for all kinds of odors, hampers, the whole bit. And it's really effective stuff. It won't harm your skin. It's really a necessity. If you wear ballistic body armor, or if you want to use it for just home use, this is some really good stuff. And it's only available at StinkyVest.com. Go take a look at it. It's put out by a law enforcement organization, and it eliminates odors without harmful chemicals, pet odors, the whole bit. So check it out. That's StinkyVest.com. See their products, and it is worthwhile. For those of you who are involved in investigative work, there is an amazing software that you've got to take a look at from Blue Light LLC. And Blue Light is a company owned by a retired Special Forces Sergeant Major. He is a strong supporter of law enforcement. And this software is amazing. It is incredible for conspiracy investigations, narcotics investigations, homicide. It's called Analyst Notebook. And it's a product that has been used very, very successfully in bringing down a lot of bad guys. The reason the Special Forces Sergeant Major got involved in it is because he used to use it in the Middle East for discovering IED, improvised explosive devices, originators, and their networks. But it's great for civilian police work. So check it out, Blue Light LLC, it's Analyst Notebook, and it is an amazing product. Check it out.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutLoud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
With me today in the interview room of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a very interesting guest with a fascinating story. It's a story of justice unfulfilled. Her name is Lori Cooper. She is the daughter of a police officer, Columbus police officer, who was shot in the line of duty, and justice was never served. but not for lack of trying, because Lori Cooper did not lay down. Lori, thanks so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement.
Randy, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure, truly. I'm really excited about being with you today.
That's great. That's great. I'm excited about having you. Now, your story
thank
is fascinating.
You. Thank you.
Let's talk about your dad as he served the people of Columbus.
Well, interestingly, when he joined the Columbus Police Department in the 60s, Randy, it was just a couple of years later that Columbus developed a mid-watch elite unit that was sort of along the lines of a SWAT type of unit called D Platoon. And there were about 50 police officers who were assigned to this platoon, half of which served half of the city, and the other 25 officers served the other half of the city. And the dividing line was downtown Columbus's Broad and High intersection, and my dad patrolled the southeast section of that particular dividing line. And what they were charged with essentially was to respond to the most dangerous crime situations in Columbus: prison riots, Ohio State University campus riots, some of the most, heinous homicides that occurred here, burglaries, robberies, and so forth. And on this particular occasion, he and his fellow D Company officers were dispatched to a number of home invasions that were occurring, and they were in progress, essentially, in a neighborhood on the city's southeast side in March of 1972. He and his partner interrupted a burglary ring that was comprised of three men on the night of March 15th of that year. And these men were, for all intents and purposes, career criminals who had a methodical way of going about burglarizing neighborhoods. They would select a particular area, although they were not from Columbus. They were from Dayton, which was an hour away from Columbus. They would go away from the area in which they lived and select these neighborhoods, and then they would case them for a week at a time to watch the comings and goings of the folks in an effort to hopefully not encounter them. But on this particular night, these men had made a number of mistakes, and so, technology being what it wasn't back then, it took a while, about an hour, for these officers to determine that one call, after another was coming into the dispatch center. And so more and more officers then were, dispatched to go to that area. And my dad and his partner interrupted what was an attempt of two of the three men to commit a burglary in a house in which this couple, a very young couple, had come home from church. And they knew something was wrong. Their dog wasn't barking. And they happened to see my dad and his partner in the cruiser, flagged them down, and they pulled in. And so my dad and his partner offered to take a look. My dad's partner took the back of the house. My dad took the front of the house. And pretty soon, gunfire erupts, and these two men come, basically running, for their lives out of the backyard. And my dad's partner took one of the men, and my dad began a chase of the other man, and that man happened to shoot him. My dad caught up with him very quickly, and attempted to take him to the ground, and the man shot him at point-blank range with a 9mm, literally nearly blowing his arm off. And thus began then the whole series of events. My dad did return fire, and allegedly, and I say allegedly because we've never seen this man, allegedly paralyzed Mr. Hayes, the suspected shooter. So both were taken to our only level 1 trauma hospital here in Columbus. And
wait a minute. So let me stop you right there. So
sure.
When your father was shot, he returned fire and hit the suspect?
He did. They were actually on the ground, and apparently, from all indications and all records that I have, my dad was able to fire a shot, and essentially that shot landed in Mr. Hayes's abdomen, and eventually, I'm not certain how quickly, paralyzed him. So, again, both of them were taken to the same hospital, which is something that Columbus doesn't do any longer. They don't take the police officer and the suspected shooter to the same hospital anymore.
Right.
But they did back in 1972. And so, anyway, from that point forward then, my dad was in traction. He was in the hospital for 30 days. The suspected shooter, whose name was, or is, excuse me, because he's still alive and lives in Dayton. He's back in Dayton, Ohio, I should say. Was, again, allegedly paralyzed. He was in the hospital for a little longer than my father was. And my dad, after being released, then had to continue to go back into the hospital for quite a number of varying degrees of surgeries to graft bone from his hip, his leg, his entire left side to try to put his arm back together. And so that basically took a year. In the meantime, the second accomplice that night was apprehended, taken to jail. He was indicted. The third accomplice, who was the getaway driver, was located about 3 days later. He had taken off out of the neighborhood when he saw the cruisers, and he too was indicted on the same 14 felony charges, as was Mr. Hayes. He was indicted while he was in the hospital, and again, all three of them were indicted on the same 14 felony charges, including the intentional shooting, that's what it was called back in 1972, of a police officer. Now, those two men actually pled out, and they served time in back then, which was, you know, like one of the worst prisons in Ohio. It was actually located in downtown Columbus. It was called the Ohio Penitentiary. And each of them pled out to a certain number of those 14 felony charges, and one of them served 8 years. The other one served, I think, three and a half years. Mr. Hayes, however, and this is kind of where things start to get a little shady, and we're not, you know, we weren't really sure at that time what was going on. And but he was allowed out on an OR bond, and somehow
Wait, hold on a second. So this sure. guy shoots your father, and he's released on an own recognizance bond?
He was. Yeah, he was basically given a get-out-of-jail-free card with the caveat, and let me throw this into the ring, that he be rehabilitated.
What does that mean, that he be rehabilitated?
Well, what they did, and it was to send him to a Cleveland VA hospital because he had been a veteran in the Korean War, apparently, be rehabilitated to allegedly come back to Columbus, and the rehabilitation program was basically, you know, a program that was supposed to, you know, make him strong enough to come back to Columbus, stand trial for the intentional shooting of my
dad.
Okay,
so this was a physical rehabilitation program.
Correct.
He shoots your father.
Correct.
They give him an OR release.
Correct.
For him to go to a rehab center.
Correct.
To make him well enough to stand trial.
You got it.
Okay, I understand. Go ahead.
Okay, so that happens, and the other men go to prison, and my dad, over the ensuing year, begins, you know, a number of, you know, the surgeries that he went through, and 18 months, well, he goes back to work for the police department, and 18 months later, this man never comes back to Columbus. In fact, what happened, and this, you know, I uncovered in, you know, all of my work to obtain records and find out exactly what the hell happened and why somebody who would attempt to take the life of a police officer would never spend a day in jail. What happened was, in the process of his being, Mr. Hayes's being rehabilitated, the director of the hospital in Cleveland sent the director of our Bureau of Motor Vehicles a letter asking that the state of Ohio relinquish Mr. Hayes's driver's license to the Cleveland hospital so that they could, in fact, teach Mr. Hayes to drive a handicapped vehicle. Now, you know, I don't know what part of being rehabilitated on a physical level to be able to stand trial for 14 felony counts includes teaching somebody how to drive a car, but I wouldn't know why he would need to drive a car. But in teaching him to do that, he was able 18 months later to drive himself away from the hospital and never come back to Columbus, Ohio again.
Okay, so he goes into rehab, ostensibly, and he's released on his own recognizance, to rehab to make him well enough to stand trial.
Correct.
And then they teach him how to drive.
That's correct. And so at that point, then, he was gone. He was nowhere to be found. He was just gone.
Okay. Did they issue a warrant for his arrest?
They did. And so and then here are where things continue to kind of continue to get out of control. So he gets arrested a couple of years later in Kentucky, and Kentucky notifies Ohio that Mr. Hayes is in their possession, apparently in running a wants and warrants check. Back then, they uncovered this warrant for Mr. Hayes's arrest. They notify Ohio notifies the governor's office, who in turn issues an extradition warrant. Two police officers are assigned to go pick him up in Kentucky, but that didn't happen.
What do you mean it didn't? He was a fugitive. The Kentucky police arrest him. They discover that
Correct.
He was a fugitive. So why wasn't he picked up?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. In fact, what he had done was he had replaced his own getaway driver with himself. Now that he had been taught how to drive, he was in, you know, his new capacity of continuing to be a career criminal driving the getaway vehicle. He had, you know, put together a new ring of people, and so he was apprehended in Kentucky. Kentucky did all of the right things. It seemed that Ohio began to, you know, precipitate all of the right paperwork to go pick him up, and even down to assigning two particular officers to pick him up, and then that didn't happen. So what happens then? Nobody comes and gets him. Kentucky releases him, and he's gone again. And throughout...
What year was this?
This would have been 1974.
So about 2 years after he shot your father.
Correct. So about 2 years later, so he's gone. You know, again, this is something that, you know, my dad really doesn't discuss with us as a family. He, you know, goes about, you know, trying to get well himself, goes back to work. We try to put our lives back together as a family, which is really hard. And in the process then, you know, once in a great while, the subject would come up, and, you know, the only thing that we knew was that his suspected shooter's name was Charles Hayes, that he was gone at one point, and then
How old were you at this point?
I was 9 years old.
My father was
29 years old.
Your dad was 29, okay. So, of course, at that age, you're not aware of all the stuff that's going on with this, with the fugitive warrant and him not getting picked up.
Well, not to that degree. In fact, my dad wasn't really aware of all of that either.
Uh-huh.
I didn't hear until 1976 when I was in 1976. I was getting ready to enter high school in the ninth grade, and we received a call from a newspaper reporter in Connecticut, and Mr. Hayes had wound up in Connecticut, and he had been arrested in the state of Connecticut, I believe it was Hartford, for, you know, continuing to commit more burglaries.
Mm-hmm.
And a reporter wanted to speak with my dad, and so anyway, then we learned that Mr. Hayes was again, you know, back in business, you know, committing what he did, you know.
Right, being a career criminal.
Entire life.
Right.
Yeah, exactly, being a career criminal. So my dad's advice of that, and, you know, I don't really know, Randy, this is an issue that is, you know, quite perplexing as to, you know, who told my father what, because in the very beginning when all of this occurred, my dad was told that Mr. Hayes was, you know, a long-term career criminal who had committed so many crimes that there just wasn't going to be enough time in my dad's lifetime for Mr. Hayes to ever stand trial for, you know, the intentional shooting of my father. And yet, you know, we would hear different bits and pieces, you know, in time about some of these things occurring, like, you know, the rehabilitation program for Mr. Hayes, and then, you know, the car and so forth. But again, just, you know, very, very, very small bits and pieces. And I'll be honest with you, my father was not the type of person who questioned authority. He went about his life and tried to, you know, resume it with as much normalcy as he could, despite the fact that he had a completely now useless left arm. And I think really going backwards, as I looked into this more and began to uncover and unravel and reveal what actually happened, I know now that my dad had a lot of fear as to being pushed out of the department, you know, because of his injury. Yeah, he had a useless left arm. At one time, they were suggesting, you know, and trying to talk him into taking 66 2/3 disability, and there was just no way, you know, he was going to do that, and no way did he want to do that. And the only thing really, aside from his, you know, his high school, you know, football career and all the scholarships that he earned to play football at any university of his choosing, that he wanted to do was to be a police officer.
Sure.
So
of course.
This was a really, really, really difficult injury for him. This was a difficult thing for our family to go through.
So he never recovered from being shot.
No, he didn't. And in spite of, you know, all of the nuts and bolts and screws and metal and surgeries and bone grafts and so forth that he went through, they never, you know, were able to make his arm useful again. He couldn't twist it or turn it like you or I can.
Okay, so we have to move on. We have to get to the where you began this journey to and get this man convicted.
My dad passed away in 2013, and he suffered a stroke on the entire left side of his body, which is where his injury was and all of his surgeries were. And I talked to doctors, you know, and asked them if they thought that it was related back to, you know, the injuries, the surgeries, the metal, et cetera. And they said likely, although, you know, there was no proof, you know, real hard proof of that. And about 2 years after he passed, after we had, you know, tried to settle his business affairs and, you know, went through the whole grieving process, I just was determined, because we really didn't know through the years what the hell had happened,
right,
and where Mr. Hayes was, and did he, you know, was he stuck, you know, in prison for life for, you know, committing some heinous crime, you know, against somebody else. I just decided that, you know, it was time to determine where he was, what happened, why he never served a day of time for trying to kill my dad. And that's when I just started unraveling all of these pieces to this, you know, ginormous puzzle. And in the process, that's when I, you know, uncovered the warrant that was, by the way, still active in 1972 in Ohio. The statute of limitations basically didn't expire on any felony warrant that was issued against somebody. So,
hold on a second. So after your dad's death is when you really took an active interest in finding out what happened to the man who shot him. And where did this search lead?
It led basically to our elected prosecutor, who decided that with a warrant that was still active, that, you know, he was going to pursue prosecution of Mr. Hayes, which is something that should have been done, you know, 44 years before.
Exactly. Well, were you able to find this guy Hayes?
I did.
Where did you find him?
I found him. He lives in Dayton, Ohio, about an hour from Columbus.
How did you find him?
The internet is a wealth of information.
Wow. So you located the man 44 years after your dad was shot. You found this suspect who was still wanted on the warrant for shooting him. And then you went to the district attorney's office, said,
I did.
Here he is, do something.
I did.
And did they?
Yes. Our elected prosecutor, Ron O'Brien, is pro police all the way, and he wasn't our elected prosecutor at the time, so he said absolutely he would begin the process. And he wasn't, you know, really optimistic that we would, you know, successfully adjudicate the case and, you know, basically get a ruling from a judge that would put Mr. Hayes away, but nevertheless he was willing to try. And so that's what we did, but we had to, some legal nuances required that our prosecutor first present the case to a judge to, you know, basically explain everything that had occurred throughout the 44 years and the fact that Mr. Hayes had been arrested twice. You know, and each time the state of Ohio was supposed to go pick this guy up in another state and failed to do so. So what our prosecutor had to do then was to present all of these facts to a judge who would then decide if, in fact, the law would allow him to go forward with prosecution of Mr. Hayes, of, you know, for the original indictment. And then that's what we did. We went to court in February. I found him, and I began looking for him in May of 2016. I found him in August of 2016. It only took me 3 months. And then I went immediately to our elected prosecutor, Ron O'Brien's office. He immediately picked up the ball. We were in court by February of 2017. The judge did not make a ruling on the first, presentation of our case. He said he would take it under advisement. Mr. Hayes secured a public defender. He never did have to appear in court. He presented a letter from a doctor that said, you know, he was a paraplegic and would have to be, you know, transported to Columbus from Dayton in an ambulance, and that would cost the taxpayers money. So they didn't pursue, you know, the cost. It was like a $200 ambulance ride. I was really pushing that, you know, he'd be forced to come to court, but nobody made him come to court. So my family and I go to court. We, you know, we're with, you know, our prosecuting attorney, and the case is argued, and the judge takes it under advisement and then makes a ruling, and 10 days later we're back in court, and the judge basically decides that Mr. Hayes's right to his constitutional right to a speedy trial had been violated. It had been violated because the state of Ohio was aware on two separate occasions in the 1970s of his whereabouts, both in Kentucky and Connecticut, and failed to apprehend him.
Right.
And so, therefore, they prejudiced him in you know, a legal way. And
so he will never have to face the music for shooting your dad.
He will never have to face the music. Not unless I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that my dad's death, you know, was 100% directly related back to his original injury, and
right.
I have, you know, not been able to do that. So we did have an ability to appeal. Unfortunately, I pushed like hell to, you know, to go through the appeals process and maybe give us some more time to try to conjure up, you know, more legal, you know, precedent setting cases or something to that effect, because I was just really determined that this man shot my father. He shot a police officer. He tried to kill him, and he didn't have to serve a day of jail time for it. And yet his two accomplices, you know, did. One served 8 years and the other one served 3.5 years. So it just, you know, it was infuriating.
I'm sure it was. Well, we're running out of time here, Lori, but I can tell you this, that your doggedness, your apprehension of this suspect, this man who shot your dad, I can't imagine the feeling that you must be going through, knowing that that he's going to be unscathed for the rest of his life because of a legal technicality, basically, and some incompetence on the part of the Ohio authorities, which clearly dropped the ball in this case. But one thing's for sure, he'll never forget you. And
no, he doesn't forget me. His family, you know, has tried to, you know, to get me through my social media accounts and sabotage, while they were successful, actually, in, you know, sabotaging one of the posts. I had shared a newspaper article that was national, and it was public. Whenever you share a newspaper article, it's public. You can't change the setting, and they were able to get on my Facebook page and just, you know, blast my family and myself. But
that's even more pathetic.
Absolutely. There are so many more details to this case than you could imagine. But so many so that I have begun writing a book. So,
well, you let me know when that book comes out. We'll have you back on the show.
I would love that. That would be fabulous.
That sounds great.
So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for showcasing, you know, our story and giving us this platform. It's wonderful. You have so many great law enforcement officers and supporters, and we're just grateful.
Well, I appreciate it, Lori. Thank you for coming on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and sharing that story.
Those of you who have followed me for any length of time know that in addition to being a 33-year law enforcement officer, I'm also an author. I've written 4 books: The True Blue, Police Stories by Those Who Have Lived Them; A Cop's Life; True Blue to Protect and Serve; and my latest book, which was actually just released only a couple weeks ago, is The Power of Legacy: Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. It's a much different book than what I've written before, but it is truly an inspirational book, because I had traveled the country talking to people who have done amazing things with their lives, people like Frank Shankwitz, who, when he was an Arizona State Trooper, created the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Gary Sinise, who's done amazing things for military and law enforcement, and a number of people, some names you know, some names you don't, but this book is full of inspiration, changed my life doing this book. Now, here's something I'm going to share with you. You know, I have a lot of Facebook followers. You know, more than 25,000 of them. But Facebook is not allowing me to share the message of my book. I think they call it shadow banning, and it's very, very disturbing. So I'm going to ask your help. First of all, I would love for you to go to Amazon.com. It's available on Kindle. It's available on audiobook, and of course in hardcover and softcover. I would love for you to pick up a copy of this book, share it with your children, because it is full of inspiration about how everyone can become a personal hero. But I'd also ask you to share this information with your friends on Facebook and other social media, because I'm fighting an uphill battle. Shadow banning is a real thing. I go to share it with my followers, and it keeps on getting unapproved, saying it's too political. There's nothing political about this book. It's about good people. I'd ask for you to share this message. I need your help to get this message out, because this book can change the world. When you talk about becoming a personal hero, you change the life of one person. You add to that person's life, and you change the world. So if you would, check me out on Amazon.com. All my books are available there. But The Power of Legacy, Personal Heroes of America's Most Inspiring People. And I appreciate your support. To all my active duty law enforcement out there, as well as if you are a business owner, you need security, I want you to listen to this message. This is really important, because there is an organization out there. It's a company called Law Enforcement Specialists. And they're out of Arizona, but they have a full nationwide reach for employing off-duty officers for security and traffic assignments. You know, almost every law enforcement officer I know works, they call them extra jobs, in order to make ends meet. Because let's face it, we're not exactly paying our law enforcement officers a whole lot of money. So they have to do extra jobs in order to make ends meet and put food on the table and have a couple vacations. So law enforcement specialists, they have agreements with all kinds of police agencies around the country. You have to just contact them and they will put you to work. So if you are a law enforcement officer, you want to work extra assignments, these jobs that come up sometimes through your department, but you can get more of them through law enforcement specialists. So check them out at offdutypoliceofficers.com. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. And if you are in need of security, if you are in need of hiring law enforcement officers for security or traffic assignments, give them a call as well. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com. Phone number is 855-976-4757. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that these folks know what they're doing, and they are dedicated to assisting law enforcement officers. That's offdutypoliceofficers.com.
End of Watch with Randy Sutton.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we pay our respects to the men and women of the profession who have made the ultimate sacrifice, given their lives in the line of duty and service to their communities. I have two names to read this week. The first is Clay County, Florida Deputy Ben Zerbel. Deputy Zerbel had been struck while on his motor unit several days prior to his death, and he lost his life in the hospital after this terrible accident. Clay County Deputy Ben Zerbel. End of Watch. August 22nd, 2018. The second officer was Police Officer Kathleen O'Connor Funagiello of the New Rochelle Police Department in New York. Police Officer Kathleen O'Connor Funagiello died as a result of cancer that she developed following her assignment to assist with search and rescue efforts at the World Trade Center immediately following the 9/11 terrorist attack. She had served with the New Rochelle Police Department for 20 years. She survived by her husband and three stepchildren. Police Officer Kathleen O'Connor Fundiello, New Rochelle Police Department, New York. End of Watch, Thursday, August 16th, 2018. May these officers rest in peace. I want to thank you for listening once again to Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Now, I want you to keep in mind that this radio broadcast, podcast that is heard and downloaded, is also on Live Talk Radio. It reaches about 200,000 people, has about 200,000 listens on Live Talk Radio, and about 100,000 downloads on podcast. A large law enforcement audience, of course, and people that support us. So if you are an advertiser and you want to reach this audience, I would ask you to contact me at randylsutton@live.com. That's randylsutton@live.com. And we can talk about advertising your business on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.